Welcome back to another episode of East in the Arena, where we talk to East members about the unique things they do, why they do them, and how. I'm your host, Sean Murley, and I'm joined by my regular co-hosts, Mike Radomski and Jeremy Levin. But you're also going to notice an unfamiliar voice, and that is Caitlin Ritter.
Hey guys, I'm Caitlin Ritter. I'm a trauma and acute care surgeon at Metro Health Medical Center in Cleveland, Ohio. I actually did my residency in Cleveland at the Cleveland Clinic before I went out to Denver for 2 years for my fellowship and then came back here for my first job. So I'm in the city by the lake and loving it.
Awesome. Did you and Mike ever overlap at all?
No, we didn't.
No, we didn't. Although Mike's legacy is quite legendary out in Denver. We still talk about
him. Oh, no. Oh, really?
Oh, Michael.
I didn't know I had a legacy.
Oh, Michael.
What did I do?
Oh, Caitlin, you're going to have to spill the beans now.
I want to know.
You know, for that, I think we'd have to have an offline conversation.
Oh, come on. Now I'm just curious.
God. All right. Well, welcome to the team, Caitlin.
Caitlin, welcome to your first team recording. It's going to be great.
Now, for this episode, I had a chance to meet with John Messing, a trauma nurse practitioner from Inova Health in Virginia. What's really interesting is that John started his career off at Penn, which is where I am, and then spent some time at George Washington University, which is where Jeremy and Mike did their residency. Mike and Jeremy had a lot of great things to say about John Messing. He really left an impact on them and their education.
John's got such a driven story around trauma. John is somebody you always want on your team.
The thing I remember most about John is that everything he approaches, it's with the humility of wanting just to learn. He's just so effective. He's just so intelligent. He's just so eloquent in how he approaches things. And you would never know that he is just better than you. Like, not as like a clinician, but also as a human being. He's just, well, maybe I'm speaking personally, he's better than me. Because he's just such a humble guy.
I'll second that. He's better than you.
This is a low bar. The low bar. But he's just a humble guy, and like he just wants to make you and the people around him better. And by virtue of doing that, he gets better.
Yeah. I mean, he's just really going after the greater good, I feel like. And he's trying to better himself while he's doing it.
We love you, John.
Okay. So with that, let's hear a little bit about John from the man himself.
I'm from South Florida. I completed my bachelor's in nursing at Villanova after working at Penn for a couple of years. Ended up pursuing my acute care nurse practitioner degree through the University of Pennsylvania.
It was that experience that really exposed him to trauma critical care and piqued his interest in it.
And so I knew when I graduated that's something I wanted to do. I had a little bit of a circuitous path to get there. Ultimately, when one of the surgeons who was at Penn relocated to Washington, D.C., I took my first real position in trauma, EGS, critical care at George Washington University Hospital.
While he was there, he became their lead nurse practitioner in trauma.
I also developed their first residency style, or sometimes you would call it fellowship. I really have been adopting the language of postgraduate training program for NPs and PAs who are interested in trauma critical care.
He did that for about 4 years.
In 2019, I transitioned over to Inova Health System in North Virginia as their advanced practice provider, transitioned to practice program manager, which allows me to support new grads across all practice settings, all five of our hospitals, 180 or so care sites, but still work clinically with the surgical trauma ICU team over at Inova Fairfax.
It's just incredible to hear that John's passion for education, helping get that fellowship up and running, and really probably one of the first of its kind in the country and pretty much becoming standard. I know Metro has one. It's just a great way to really help give people some dedicated education within trauma, which really is its own unique space that you need specialized kind of skills and protocols and understandings for. So Even at an APP level, you've got people that are as dedicated to education as you find at the senior faculty level.
Yeah,
that's definitely a big deal, Caitlin. But John's involvement in medicine goes beyond teaching and working clinically at his own institution. He's very involved in organized medicine at the national level with groups like EAST and the Society of Trauma Nurses.
For a number of years, the two organizations had a committee that had a lot of overlap for advanced practice providers. And so I've been involved in that.
EAST used to run an APP workshop during the conference that John actually helped develop.
I worked with a former EAST president and some other EAST members to write a paper about advanced practice providers. I think that was published in 2017. So that's been a big part of my EAST involvement, attending the annual scientific assembly and just being a participant with their APP work.
He actually just finished his term as director at large on the board of STN.
I've been serving in that capacity as the liaison to the Government Affairs and Public Policy Committee, which has allowed me to spend some time lobbying on Capitol Hill and also helping them to develop some of their own position statements.
You know, one thing of many that I'm jealous of when it comes to nursing as a profession is their incredible ability to lobby for change.
Yeah.
And they do it really, really well.
From a physician standpoint, we're just late to the ballgame for that. They're light years ahead of us.
We talk about things that we can learn from each other. They really have a better grasp of kind of the whole healthcare system, a little better than I think a lot of us in medicine and especially surgery do, understanding the importance of lobbying and industry and relationships with all of these different organizations that impact how we get paid, how our patients get care, and how people get taken care of in the United States.
Do you think it comes from that they had a job before they had the job, right? They were nurses at the bedside. They saw how the sausage is made in a very different way. And so when they're in a nurse practitioner role or an APP role, like they just have a very different perspective.
Yeah.
Typically, if you're coming right out of undergrad, you commit to medical school when you're like 22, and then your next 4 years to 9 years is kind of all laid out in front of you. Whereas if you're a nurse, you go to undergrad, you go to nursing school, then you get out and you work and you see what you really like to do. And then you kind of make your choice. I just feel like you probably have a little bit more information to make that choice.
You mean the decision I made when I was 17 to shape the rest of my career didn't make me well adapted? 17-year-old Caitlin was brilliant, okay? My hair was pink.
Could tell her no wrong, right?
No, just ask my mother.
Now, every APP group is going to be a little different. Let's hear about how John's group is structured and how it functions.
It looks a little bit different for everybody because we, at this point, we have two of our hospitals, our trauma centers. When you look at like a level two, level three, how an APP functions is different than those at a level one.
And it's not necessarily because a level one has more exciting or higher acuity patients, but actually because of the presence of a resident complement.
For those of us who work at our level one trauma center, if you are assigned to the surgical trauma ICU, you have a set of responsibilities. And then those who are assigned to the floor have their own set. And then there's also those who are assigned to the emergency general surgery service.
Now, Mike, you wanted to bring up something interesting at your hospital that dovetails really well into the next section that John brings up.
For activations, we have a dedicated trauma bay resident 24/7. And then at nighttime, we have an APP in addition to that. So we have a resident and an APP down in the trauma bay. And we have found that there used to be a lot of animosity between the APPs and the residents because they never really worked together all that much. So what we did this past year is we actually put them together more. And that seemed to decrease the animosity and allows for that institutional memory of like, hey, no, you don't need to call the attending surgeon for the grade two BCVI. We can just start them on aspirin or we can just do this because they know where all the protocols are. Whereas a lot of our other residents that are rotating through, they're not familiar with our system.
Gosh, I don't even know where half the protocols are stored. I will text my APP and be like, what's our policy for this again?
Yeah.
Your comment really segues well into the next point that John brings up. He goes into his own philosophy of how APPs should be
facilitating the development of the residents, especially at a level one trauma center, because you can't be doing the most exciting procedures at all times. Those happens kind of spontaneously, but part of it is helping them to be successful in their own training and development while we carry more of that institutional knowledge and the ins and outs of the service, the faculty, the other teams that we partner with.
When you have APPs that really integrate themselves and work closer with the resident team, they're more invested in the resident education. That's my mentality for it is I don't want the APPs to be separate of the residents. I want them to be working closer together.
Yeah.
Because they do work very synergistically. And I think that their education is even synergistic.
A rising tide lifts all ships.
I love that phrase.
When you are truly a team, when you're not segregated, it makes everything better. And it always goes back to patient care, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, making everyone's workload easier while providing better care for patients. It's about balance and sharing and really trying to get everyone to work at the top of their license.
The resident APP conundrum is a little bit of a double-edged sword, right? Because on the one hand, you have really effective APPs, they free up the residents from doing some things, right? That's great. All the notes, maybe how to discharge a patient. On the other hand, those can be essential skills because you don't know where you're going to end up practicing down the road, right? But there is definitely like a push and a pull of like, how much can APPs do? How much should they do? And are the things that they're taking from residents, are they essential? How do you balance that?
I don't know about you, but I think it's essential that my intern discharges 20 people by themselves in 2 hours. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
Back in my day, I climbed up and down the hospital steps to carry my paper charts.
I wrote it in the paper chart. I coded the EMR. I made up the stupid pop-up warnings.
The pop-up warnings. You're the person I'm supposed to strangle.
Yeah.
Now, John really starts to dive into the roles of the APPs and what they do within a trauma program as a whole outside of clinical work.
One, we attend all the PI meetings and the trauma monthly multidisciplinary meetings. Our voice is heard in those settings.
If there's a particular case that an APP is more familiar with, they may be asked to present it.
The APPs are being engaged more within the last year or two at my institution. I know that there are other settings where they might be more prominently featured with PI and with presenting cases. I know where I used to work, I would have one or two cases almost every month to present, and they usually weren't cases I was familiar with so that I could bring in a fresh take.
I think the concept of like, if you're not including your APPs into the process of running your center, you're limiting yourself. I think it's right on. Right? They bring a different perspective. They have a wealth of knowledge and training. They're the institutional memory. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense. They're a good resource.
What else do APPs get involved in?
It's more just like projects that will pop up that seem to be appropriate for an APP. And sometimes it's something that really we just want an advanced practice provider to own this because they are doing most of the documentation or they do a good amount of it. So this is a good person to look over changes to our note format.
Whereas other times there might be a resident interested in doing a specific research project, and it might be helpful to engage the APPs to brainstorm or provide context along the way.
But I think it's more just occasional projects that pop up, not necessarily standing. We have new leadership within our system for trauma, and I think there are a lot of positive changes that are engaging the APPs even more than they have historically. And I think that's exciting.
Having seen firsthand how John approaches the PI thing, and then just to name drop some people because they're wonderful human beings, Caroline Baines, Lori Ford, who are Vanderbilt NPs, and then how they approach PI, Bethany, they just do it from a different perspective. And I really think it comes from their nursing background and like the level of ownership they would take, the perspective they bring in is different than the way an MD would. And so what you get to the PI process is just a more holistic approach to whatever issues being discussed.
APPs have the benefit of being the boots on the ground and also the pilot in the airplane.
Yeah.
Having both of those perspectives can really help you think about your PI process in a very different way that those of us who've been sitting on the airplane our entire career might not necessarily understand.
Man, Caitlin is like the adage expert. She's so wise.
The wise old sage.
It's on the money. It's so on the money.
A lot has changed for the APPs over the years at John's program, and fortunately for the better. Some of those things include
having a seat at the table, to things that are more APP specific, like putting together a APP skill-based training course for surgery. And those are things that haven't always received a lot of attention. So I think that's positive change.
It's not enough to just have APPs join your team. You really have to support them through continued education. Take a listen to how APP education is supported at John's program.
One, when it comes to how you integrate your advanced practice providers within an organization or within a health system, there's a lot you can do there.
Postgraduate training programs have their strengths and weaknesses and can be a bit controversial at times.
their broader programs. I know that Penn has one, we have one, other health systems do, that focus a little bit more on how do APPs fit in, what kind of professional development do they get, what organizational resources are available to them. They provide that more in like a multi-month orientation type program. There are even third parties, not specific to an organization, but companies like Vizient that are putting these together for both APPs and physicians that are new to organizations.
At the end of the day, those programs are going to provide exposure to resources in general, but you really have to have something specific to the team.
One is for advanced practice providers, it's common for people to orient them by just having some shadowing and gradual independence. And I don't think that's the best model. I think you really need to have goals and milestones and think about how they're going to advance week by week.
I was using a lot of the same words that GME uses, right? Like the ACGME milestones, we've got EPA is coming out. Like he's using all of the words that graduate medical education has used for years for physicians and residents, but he's applying that to an APP lens, which I think is something we can kind of all get behind because it's something we're familiar with and we know works.
Yeah,
that's a great point. My discussion with him was very eye-opening because he had a really different take on this than what I expected going in. His opinion on APP education was very measured, logical, and practical. He really believes in methodical training with a focus on patient safety and avoiding stepping on the toes of other providers.
Yeah.
For example, for a new grad, he believes that the orientation process should really be
at least 90 days, probably closer to 6 months. And during that time, when you think about critical care and you think about trauma and EGS, how much overlap, you may want to build in time for certain things that are a requirement.
Like ATLS, if they're going to the trauma bay.
But to other things that aren't necessarily a requirement, but are very complementary.
Like FCCS.
Or you could maybe have them audit certain courses that are offered. You can try to carve out more time so that they can attend lectures and be present and engaged so that they're learning that material.
Getting them engaged in journal clubs.
Really starting to thoughtfully think about the care that they're delivering for the patients and how they fit into the team.
So there are tons of ways to educate them and support the development of their role on this team. Now, this wouldn't be an In the Arena podcast if we didn't cover the why and the how. And like Simon Sinek says, start with your why. John brings up a fair number of reasons to explore adding APPs to your practice.
Thinking about the why is, what kind of institution are you? Like, what resources do you have available? Because that's going to lead you to a different solution if you're working with residents versus if you're working without residents.
If you're working with residents,
how compliant are they with their work week hour restrictions? Are they getting their cases in? Are they able to adequately cover those and having their learning needs met without violating their hours regularly?
And if they are, well, you're starting to develop a business case and an academic case that you need more personnel.
And not everybody has the opportunity to expand their residency. Then you need to start thinking about, well, am I going to have my faculty do more of this work so that my residents can learn?
Now, here's a loaded question. How do you guys feel about that?
Hard pass.
I don't know how to say my opinions politically correctly, so I'm just going to be quiet.
I agree.
Well, all right, so in all seriousness, to give credence to the comment, the reality is, right, medicine's super fast-paced, right? Things are changing, and not just like the knowledge, but the logistics of medicine are changing all the time.
Oh, constantly.
There was a new order set in our hospital that came online last week, and I remember looking at it, and I'm like, I have no idea how to navigate anymore, which shows my age. But like, so it's evolving very quickly. So the idea that the attending, who the system is asking for other things, they want you operating, they want you providing high-level patient care, they want you being academic, they want you being an educator, they're asking all these things, something has to give, and it depends on your setting. If you're in a private practice level 2 with like one APP and it's you and your partners, you're going to know all that stuff because you have to. You're an academic institution doing all the other things. My transactional memory can be in the people that know how to do that. I'm going to do the other things that the job requires, and I have no qualms saying that I don't know how to do that stuff.
if that's not an option, well, then maybe I need to start having more advanced practice providers or start to hire them. I think that's what a lot of places, especially with these level one centers, have faced. And that's a starting point. Others, it might be maybe they need to do this more from a quality perspective.
Maybe it's more from a billing and revenue perspective.
I think there are a number of different arguments that you can make. And then if you don't have residents, then it's largely falling onto your surgeons. And at some point, if you're a successful center, your volume is going to go up and you're going to need to hire more. And you can only have so many of your surgeons available. And for them to be able to have their needs met and their interests and the cases they want, I'm a nurse practitioner, not a surgeon. So it's not my role to be in the OR. I'm happy to be there if I'm needed. I want to do what's best for the patient and for the team. But if you're using me appropriately and you've trained me appropriately, I'm allowing you to comfortably and confidently focus your attention,
whether that's in the OR, the trauma bay, or in the clinic,
while I'm dealing with other things. And our communication is strong enough that should I be concerned, I can reach out to you and I know you're going to pick up the phone and we're going to have a dialogue as to what's necessary for this patient. And it just, those needs are going to be individualized based off of the center and what you guys are facing.
What he just explained is the true meaning of an effective force multiplier, a group of competent providers who work together with a shared trust to extend the reach of that surgeon. But there's a process to get there, and the first step is you need data.
If you're able to identify that data and map it out and then work with your department leadership to discuss, you know, what is your current state and what's your future state and what are the barriers and facilitators to get there, that all needs to be defined. But the data is going to drive the journey.
Once you've developed the business case, step two is
you need to be intentional with who you're hiring,
whether that's a new grad,
which is hard if that's your first person. It's very, very difficult. But it's not impossible.
Versus someone who's experienced.
There are advantages, disadvantages there. You bring someone who's experienced in, it makes it a little bit easier, but sometimes they carry their own bad habits. They bring their own history with them. Whereas a new grad, you need to be very patient and willing to help them through it.
Whoever that is, step three is to
really carve out that time to develop them and help them to learn the service and to develop a deep sense of trust and that concept of psychological safety so that when they inevitably make a mistake, they can comfortably come to you and talk about it and work through it, as opposed to, you know, feel like they need to cover it up or hide it or go to somebody else.
I love that word, psychological safety. It's so important.
Yeah.
Feeling safe, feeling like you can talk to someone about issues, concerns when you make a mistake. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when and how we respond to it and how we learn from it. And that's the important thing.
Yeah.
Once you've fostered that relationship, get them deeply ingrained into your trauma program. Step four involves
getting them engaged in your PI, having them attend your faculty meetings if you have one. You don't have to have all of them, but like have a point of contact, that person who can be there and be the voice and say like, hey, you know, like this works and or this doesn't, and this is why, because they bring that perspective. Otherwise, you're always kind of giving yourself a bit of a handicap if you don't have a voice from all of your team members present and participating.
John brings it home by sharing what he thinks is one of the best ways to maintain competence as an APP, besides just working clinically.
I'm a believer in professional societies. So as an NP, I look at EAST, the Society of Trauma Nurses, and I think that those are two really healthy, good organizations to support your development. So I would encourage them to join one of those, if not both. If you're a PA, I would encourage them to look at the American Academy of Surgical PAs.
But he says it's not enough to just join.
It's one thing to pay your dues. A lot of people do that and they put it on their resume, but you're not getting the full value out of your organization if you don't show up, you don't participate in committees, you don't build those relationships that make you more marketable and provide you that education and context should your career take you elsewhere.
John did a really great job of that, from what I remember. I mean, he really got involved and presented and things like that. When I was at fellowship, Dr. Paracci got the APPs involved quite a bit for presentations as well on papers and got them involved in research. I think really folding them into the kind of the research arm and the presentation arm and being a part of those societies really goes a long way.
John's humility really came through in his final words and closing thoughts. And his perspective and philosophy on patient care and working as a team is really quite evident.
When I look back on my own development and my own career journey, which I remain on, I am profoundly grateful to the surgeons who have taken the time to teach me and develop me and challenge me and hold me to a higher standard. And those are people that I've worked with in the clinical setting, but also those from East and other organizations. And if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be able to function at the level that I can.
John, thank you so much for joining us on East in the Arena. You are truly a shining example of a leader in trauma care, both amongst advanced practice providers and physicians. East in the Arena is a product of the Educational Resources Committee and was created by Jeremy Levin, Sean Murley, and Mike Radomski. If you want to check out other East in the Arena episodes or other East products like the TraumaCast or CareerCast, visit east.org or wherever fine podcasts are found. This episode was arranged and edited by me, Sean Murley, and I hope you enjoyed it. Intro and outro music were composed and performed by Matt Holzmacher. We'll see you on the next episode.
Okay. All right. Little aside. I was a medical student on the trauma service when one Mike Radomski was the chief and one Sarah Zettervall was the intern. Right. And I remember I had, Sarah's like, do you want to write the orders? Right. This was like early on.
We were paper charts like, yeah, back then, man. We were paper charts.
I know. Yeah. So ADC, right. I had to know how to do that.
And oh,
I
wrote it down. ADC Van Dizzle.
And I wrote it down and I butchered it. It wasn't right. And you looked at it and you just took the paper and tore it out. And you're like, wrong. And that was it. that was all the feedback.
Man, I was such a good resident.
All these complex feedback tools now. Mike Radomski's had it right from the start. Wrong.
He got it. It was wrong. There was no, it was just wrong.